ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Beth Fraycorn, an Emmy Award-winning entrepreneur, creative strategist, and problem solver with an accomplished career in global entertainment production, distribution, and strategic alliances. She's applied her strategies with companies such as Disney, NHK, and Time Life, and has worked on and placed television series with NBC, ABC, CBS, ESPN, Disney, Discovery Channel, Scripps, and PBS. Beth was the former president of Compulsion Entertainment, founded Remarkable Content Group, and is currently the head of alternative content at Breakthrough Entertainment. Beth, thank you so much for joining us today. So are you ready to dive in?
I hope so.
Fantastic. Okay, let's start by giving me and the audience the executive summary of what Breakthrough Entertainment produces, and more specifically, what your role as the head of alternative content means.
Breakthrough Entertainment has been a producer and distributor of very high quality entertainment for over 30 years. They've won a numerous amount of awards for their premium content and do international co-production in feature films, television series, and digital content. The divisions are family and children's entertainment, and we do actually have a division that does horror films, and my division does alternative content, which is reality, docu-series, anything nonfiction that we can primarily sell first and foremost into the U.S. and then take rights into Canada and across the globe.
Okay. And if we're thinking about the landscape as it's changing, and for instance, I was at a breakfast meeting this week, and John Martin from Turner was talking about really focusing on original scripted materials. How do you see alternative content fitting in with this move where people are really putting a lot of eggs in that original scripted basket? And how does it work?
I think it's interesting. I think that there is always going to be an appetite for nonfiction or alternative content. I think, like anything, things go in and out of fashion. Mm-hmm. For a while, there was a huge appetite for docuseries. Now it seems like a little bit more of an appetite for always story-driven, but things that have more depth to them or interesting formats. Right now, there's a very large interest in true crime. I'm seeing a lot of the cable networks that typically haven't been involved in true crime getting involved in them, mostly because these are stories. They're mysteries for the most part. So they become very engaging for the viewer.
And is that something which then has a shelf life that then people are going to be binging on later? Is that what you're finding? So with this type of material?
Yes, I think people do binge. I mean, and it's funny because if you look at the way the programming is changing, it used to be similar minded properties would be programmed. I find that I'm seeing more and more of stacking of the same shows where they stunt show after show after show of common threads. And so I think the programming people, not a programmer, tend to be orienting themselves towards the way people are binge-watching programming. So if I turn something on at 7 o'clock, I can sit there until 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night and consistently watch that channel, that very focused channel, that very focused program.
Oh, right. So they're essentially, so it's broadcast or cable, but your experience is as if you were streaming it and you're able to consume it in that same manner. That's interesting.
I'm finding that. I don't know if that's the intent or if that's conscious, but it seems that that's happening more and more, at least from where I'm sitting.
Right, right. A lot of analysts and commentators have been discussing over the past few years the Netflix effect, and streaming viewing has improved TV content overall, that it's competitive to secure the quality properties. Are you seeing any change over the course, if you sort of take a retrospective view on where things were and how they're going? What impact do some of these pure streaming players have on the environment that you're experiencing or not?
I think that they're raising the bar a little bit, actually. I think it's interesting. I think specifically in the scripted area, more so. But I also think what I'm seeing in the nonfiction, the documentary area, there's a larger appetite for very interesting documentaries. And that affects all the nonfiction, all the alternative. So because they're raising the bar and the quality of the programming is getting a little bit better and a little bit stronger, much more story-driven, you're seeing that thread go through a lot of the other cable networks and broadcasters and it coming out in what you wouldn't typically think. I think the other thing that's happening is there's a lot of hyper-focus on certain things, competition. If you're going to do competition, you have to go very big, very, very loud on that. So I think, again, the bar just keeps getting higher and higher.
When you say competition, do you mean like the voice, like live event type competition?
I think because of the streaming, I guess this speaks to your earlier question, because of the streaming and I could go and watch it whenever I want, you then have your appointment television. So the very big events are becoming bigger and broader and stronger.
Right, right. When you're looking at picking what you're going to be doing, now obviously there's this appetite for true crime. Do you see the way you're developing properties? I mean, I imagine there has always been a certain amount of this is what people are hungry for, so this is what we're going to produce. But is the new digital landscape, does it have an impact on how you're producing content, where you're distributing it to? Has it changed, or is it pretty much the same business, you just have more parties and more places you can bring your material?
To a certain extent, I think it is business as usual in terms of you want to develop strong content. You want to develop content that will work at the broadcaster that or the cable network that you're going after, you're targeting. So I don't know that it has affected us negatively necessarily. Again, it has opened up more outlets for good content.
And so then how are you exploiting those outlets? I mean, you know, if everybody is talking about these seismic shifts that are going on, is it seismic for you? Or do you think, no, not really. It's just, you know, if anything, it just is a bigger pot of gold. I mean, what is?
I think it is a bigger pot of gold. I think the other thing that has that opportunities exist with, and I think the seismic shifts are affecting the some of the cable broadcasters in terms of maybe there's not as much money to go around because there aren't as many advertising dollars out there. But I believe that for us, when I look at a series, we look at the series and it's not, oh, it can only be a half hour, an hour. Now you can start doing short form on it. So if it doesn't work in one format, you could possibly look at it as another format. Or could you do, you know, if it works for the content. The other thing that I am finding is that where you would never find an interest or an openness to client-supplied or branded programming, more and more of the broadcasters are open to that, where you can come in with things partially funded. I think that that becomes much more attractive. And there are definitely two schools. There are the broadcasters who say, no, we want all rights. We want to be able to stream it worldwide. This is part of our library. It's not negotiable. But then I'm also finding that there is an interest where you come in with financing, again, whether that's sponsored or in our case, we come in with, you know, potentially some Canadian financing in place. It becomes much more attractive and they're open to doing those partnership arrangements.
If you are coming with the financing, and you did say that, you know, sometimes it's brand, sometimes it's Canadian government, what would you say? Is it like, how does that money split out? Is it 50-50 brands to, you know, governmental, or is it 60-40? What is the split?
You know, that's a very hard question. I don't know if I have the answer to it. I do think that the openness to looking at the different versatile financing scenarios is what I think is most interesting. That is going on right now. There was never really that much of an openness to it at a lot of these broadcasters previously.
When a brand is involved from the get-go, how does that, is it product placement? Is it integrated? Or is it just that they're helping to to fund it? How does that manifest, or are there many ways?
There are many ways. I mean, some of the networks call it client supplied. Other networks, it's just basically sponsored. And there are different windows at the different broadcasters where they will allow this programming to go on. So whether or not they are able to sell you part of the inventory, or you're able to only do some product placement, there are different combinations. And I think it's knowing the different worlds and being able to really package up the different pieces to make your property become much more attractive. And then there are other instances where if you do come with something and there's a brand associated with it, it's not attractive to that particular broadcaster. So it's really knowing your landscape and understanding how to best utilize the different opportunities out there for financing, and also what work with the broadcasters. Some broadcasters, if you do any brand placement, they want a piece of that, and that will affect your budget.
Right, of course. I mean, that's the thing. I suppose they're thinking, well, you're taking my dollars right there. How is that going to work? I want a piece of that pie.
Yeah, it's hard to get through that, because you are dealing with so many different areas. You're dealing with ad sales. You're dealing with your programming. And you don't want to dilute the show. I mean, you don't want to dilute the entertainment factor of the series that you're putting out there.
Right.
So it's very important to really strike a proper balance when you have these things, when you have all these different things at play.
Right, right. We did a survey recently of young millennials and found that ad blocking was rampant and piracy was pervasive, and that they didn't think there was anything wrong with piracy. So it was like a trifecta of horror for people producing content. And are these behaviors having an impact on you directly or indirectly, or is it really, doesn't really impact what you're doing?
I think it speaks to what we were just talking about. There's much more embedded advertising potentially. It affects us in that the ad dollars, I think, are not as strong. There aren't as many ad dollars out there, so the budgets aren't growing at the rate that I had seen them grow in the past.
Mm.
So in that respect, it does affect us. But again, if there's more consumption of content, there's more opportunity out there. That's my feeling.
Right. And are you also finding that the ability to produce the content, are you lower? Is the cost to produce lower simply because technology is making things less expensive, and also there are just more people who are trained up on using the technology in order to create and make content?
My personal experience is that not necessarily because, I mean, do you find that with what you're doing?
No, I don't. I mean, yes, please do tell the story. Because no, absolutely not. I don't find it easier, but I hear that a lot.
No, I don't find it easier. I mean, when you produce good content, look at films as a good example. Budgets of films are going up because people want more. They want more. When you used to be able to do true crime, you didn't have to do the immense amount of recreations that we find that are required at this point at a lot of the broadcasters. The visual effects. People, again, you're raising your bar, your production quality. It has to entertain, and it also has to be sticky. And when I look at millennials, they consume so much. They have, their appetite is large, but they also have they're much more decisive in what they like. And I think they are able to discern good content from bad content at a much more rapid pace. So I think the quality has to go up.
Right. Right. How about there's a certain amount of talking around, social platforms, and they're publishing video, and video is more and more important to them. Are you teaming or building anything for the social platforms?
I think whenever we do, or at least in the alternative content group, whenever we do our programming, we also consider our social platforms and promoting it onto the social platform and giving it a voice in that world. But again, social platform tends to be shorter form,
right.
And we tend to produce things that are either 30 or 60 minutes or even longer than that. So there's a complement there, but it's not something that at least my division is doing.
Right. So that wouldn't, I mean, is the promotion of your materials, usually you're selling them to the channels, which are then charged promoting them, right? Or right. do you do promotion as well?
We try to promote. I mean, we try to promote. Sometimes our talent will promote. They've got, you know, either Twitter followers or Facebook following, and they'll promote a show.
Do social profiles of people affect how you feel about developing properties?
You know, it's funny. For a while in the industry, everybody was looking at the online people for talent. They were sourcing talent. And I think for a while, people started to develop with the online talent. I don't know how successful that was. Mm-hmm. I do believe that when you are looking at greenlighting a show from a broadcaster, and again, you're going to have to talk to broadcasters on this, but when you are looking at greenlighting a show, you are looking for ways to, for other platforms to promote the show. So if you do have a semi-celebrity or celebrity or someone who has some sort of a platform, it becomes that much more attractive. And it doesn't only have to be a person. It could be a magazine. It could be a variety of different things. So I'm seeing that if there are other outreach available to help drive viewers to the channel and then to the program, it's something that becomes attractive to the broadcaster and in effect becomes attractive to us because we're developing shows to sell to the broadcasters.
Right, right. Now, your company is based in Canada, mm-hmm. but are you selling primarily in the U.S.?
Yes. Well, I personally, I'm head of alternative content for the United States, so my role is to try to get partnerships with production companies and broadcasters, and that we're able to produce both in Canada and the U.S. and anywhere around the world. So, but we're trying to sell primarily to the U.S. broadcasters, and then we partner other broadcasters in. So we'll partner in Canada and then take distribution rights and sell them worldwide.
Oh, so is that part of your bailiwick as well, selling the stuff worldwide or not so much?
We have a very strong distribution division. Uh-huh. Again, they carry 3,000 to 4,000 hours, I believe. And so once we are able to, a series, for example, that we did recently, the U.S. only wanted U.S. broadcast rights. We were then able to sell into Canada, and our distribution team is now selling it worldwide. However, we will always also do deals where we're just selling. There are certain broadcasters, as I said earlier, that like to have all rights because they want to have their library and sell to their subsidiaries around the world.
Right.
So we'll also do those straight up deals, which are more commission deals rather than licensing deals.
Right, because it's one off. Once you've sold it, that's it. Yeah?
Right. Right. For the most part. I mean, sometimes rights revert back after 7 years or by that, you know, it depends on how you structure the deal. It really is about flexibility. You know, the one thing that has changed substantially in the years since I've been doing this is the amount of options and flexibility that you need to have increased substantially. So it used to be, I'm going to buy the show from you, I'm paying for it, I'm taking all rights, or you need to have the budget to cover the cost of production. Now there are so many variations that you could do, it really ranges.
Is it sort of six of one, half dozen for the other as far as you're concerned, or are there like, well, it's my favorite when we can do it this way? What's your sort of the sweet spot you like to hit?
The sweet spot for breakthrough is you know, on the... Honestly, is we want to have the best scenarios for producing the best content. I mean, and that really will change depending on what we're doing, whether we're doing something that is, a doc or whether it's a regular series. It really is about producing high quality content. That's what we're known for. That's how we're going to expand and grow. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's one clear answer to that. Obviously, people want to keep rights, but if it's not in the interest of the show, then it's not in the interest of the show.
Right, right. One of the things also that John Martin said at the meeting was he anticipates that we'll see a certain amount of winnowing of networks, that there are simply too many cable networks out there and that we're going to see great reductions. Do you see that happening as well? Do you think that's true?
I think there's a strong potential for that. I'm seeing cross-pollination of shows, whereas a number of years ago, the broadcasters were so siloed that you couldn't share programming. Now I'm seeing that they do share programming oftentimes because people are not only going to one network for one brand. I'm also, ironically enough, at the same time seeing a lot of these broadcasters go back to their roots and try to really be defining themselves by their brand associations, because that travels to online. So if I'm looking for a specialty type of program, I'm going to look it up online. I'm going to look it up on when I'm watching television. So
right. Well, it's interesting. I was just going to ask sort of the next question is there such a thing then as a brand for a channel, or is it really that it's each program is its own micro brand, which then in constellation forms a larger brand for the channel? Or is it really that these channel brands, and where is it falling? I think it's sort of pendulum swung a certain amount.
I think that there really are definitive brands at the channels. And I think as the channels are strong in identifying the brands, your destination is going to that channel because you're expecting and planning and will watch a certain type of show.
Right.
That has a certain type of demographic associated with it, and all the advertising dollars follow along suit with that. So I do believe that channels do have brands. And the irony of all of this is that as television has changed over the years, there was more general audience.
Right.
Channels, it seems like that has lessened and the very clearly defined brands have increased. Now, there are similarities among brands, and I think that there will be a winnowing of that and that you will have some condensing going on some of the channels.
Right, right. One of the things I like to do in conversation with people is I like to just ask a series of words and get your top of head response. And I know it's you just answering off the top of your head. It's not speaking for breakthrough. It's just what these things mean to you. Just top of head, first response.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook.
Friends.
Google.
Big.
Snapchat.
Short-lived.
Hopefully. did you see they're changing their terms and conditions? They want to keep all their ad revenue. Yeah. I'm like, that's the ultimate because they're about to go public. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Twitter.
Strong.
YouTube.
Interesting.
Ad blockers.
Changing dynamic.
VR.
Really fascinating.
AR.
High growth.
AI.
Unbelievable.
Scary.
Scary. Unbelievable.
And art.
Long term.
There you go. And what are you watching? What are you consuming?
It's funny. I actually consume such a wide variety of things. It's really interesting. Depending on where I am, I will consume different things. If I'm on a plane, I will tend to watch different things than if I'm sitting at home after a long day at work. And there is something great and about the familiarity of watching TV in a classic way, where you're sitting on a couch and it's a very passive medium and you want to be entertained. And entertaining comes in so many different forms, but there's something wonderful about that. And so I do like just being able to scan through and find something that's interesting, and then I will watch it for a certain period of time. I also try to find things that we can consume as a family, because it gives us a family dynamic that we can all watch something together.
And will your family do that? Will they participate that way?
Yes. Yes, less and less so.
Because I have really have a lot of trouble doing that.
Less and less so because they're teenagers. But yes, I mean, every so often, and it's funny because my kids will, they're certain, ironically enough, I'm very surprised, there are certain scripted sitcoms. And they're like, oh, that's on, let's all watch it. And it's funny because it harkens back to, I don't know, the early 2000s.
Right, right. Funny. And what most excites you about the change that's going on in the industry?
I think the variety of content. And I think also the quality of content is increasing. So I there's just the increased amount of consumption is, again, it's making a much higher bar for higher quality, I believe, generally speaking. And there's just so much more variety and accessibility. And that to me is exciting. I mean, it's increasing our communication around the world. We're not just exporting our entertainment, we're importing, and it's increasing our communication just across the globe. And I think that's valuable. I think that's why it's an exciting place to be and a wonderful business to be in, because you're participating in that.
That's amazing. You know, that is actually something I've never heard anybody else say about consuming programming produced outside of the U.S. And I think that you're absolutely right. And that's such a good insight. I think that's really, really interesting. Is there anything that is of concern to you, that worries you, that sort of you see any sort of potential scary disruption out there?
You know what does, with that, with all the increased amount of accessibility and video and access, I think we're becoming too used to seeing violence. And it's frightening that I'll flip through a channel, and even with scripted, you know, the amount of violence, and it's something got blown off, or there's somebody who's lying there dead. And to a certain extent, that's very, very bothersome to me personally, because it keeps us from really understanding how horrible some of the images that we're watching. You know, we're becoming desensitized to it.
Well, I think that's again another thing which is absolutely true. I was actually thinking about that in relation to Penny Dreadful, which I had sort of started spinning through, and at first I thought, oh, you know, my older boy might find this interesting. And then I thought rapidly, no, I don't think so. No. But it's sort of gratuitous and unnecessary for the story, you know?
Yeah.
It's titillating.
Yes.
And yet kind of boring. I mean, ultimately it's sort of boring. But as you say, it's desensitizing and ultimately disturbing, not in the disturbing in terms of, ooh, I'm so shocked, but disturbing that it's just so pervasive.
It's very pervasive. And it's funny because you and I see it, and our reaction to it is, it is gratuitous. And when I see my kids' reaction to it, it's second nature. It doesn't bother them. And so they're not being affected by it as much. And how much more, to get that emotional response, how much more violent do you have to go? How much more extreme do you have to go? Because you're putting those images into your series or your show or your film to elicit a response, to get some sort of emotional connection. And if it keeps going up and up, and you keep having to get more and more what I would consider at least disturbing on some of these images, you know, how much further do you have to go?
Right. And it just keeps kind of, Roman bread and circus a bit.
Right.
Well, anyway, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very, very much.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few people. First and foremost is the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thank you. Our production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest and new friend, Beth Freikorn. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.